Welcome to a podcast brought to you by the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. Our academy is a national organization committed to excellence in orthopedic manual physical therapy practice, education, and research. And we're here to explore a wide range of topics with you through interviews with content experts.
Hello, my name is Stephen Schaefer, and I'm pleased to bring to you another spectacular interview. Today's guests are Dr. Vladimir Smolgovsky and Dr. Brian Swanson. Dr. Smolgovsky graduated from the University of Connecticut. He has continued his post-professional education by becoming a certified strength and conditioning specialist, certified dry needling provider, and, more recently, he completed an orthopedic residency program, which culminated with him becoming an orthopedic certified specialist. He currently works for physical therapy and sports medicine centers in West Hartford, Connecticut. Dr. Brian Swanson received his degree in physical therapy from Quinnipiac University and earned a doctorate of science from Andrews University. He is a board-certified orthopedic clinical specialist, and he completed a two-year residency and fellowship at the Institute of Orthopedic Manual Therapy in Woburn, Massachusetts. He is currently a faculty member at the University of Hartford, as well as the Select Medical Orthopedic Physical Therapy Residency Program, and has worked with multiple fellows in training as part of the AOMT fellowship process. We invited our guests to the show today because they recently co-authored a peer-reviewed case study titled The Differential Diagnosis and Treatment of a Patient with Concurrent Cervicogenic Headache, Concussion, and Hyperlaxity. You can find this article in JOSPT Cases, Volume 2, Number 2, which was published in May of 2022. As is always the case, we'll be sure to link to the article in the show notes. And with that as our introduction, let's avoid any further delay and get to the interview. Dr. Smolgovsky, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Swanson, welcome back. How are you?
Doing very well, thank you. And thank you for having me back on the podcast.
Well, we are glad to have you back, and we're excited to hear about this case. So let's jump right in. Why don't we start with meeting the patient? Please provide our audience with a brief description of who this patient was and how they presented when they came into the clinic.
Sure. So this patient was a 40-year-old Caucasian female. She had a history of insidious onset left neck pain and occipital headache, and she also had a recent concussion. About 4 weeks prior to the eval, she had the left-sided headache that she attributed to sleeping on different pillows while on vacation. And then 2 weeks later, she hit her head on a garage door and was diagnosed by a neurologist with concussion. As far as symptoms-wise, so pain ranged from 2 to 7 out of 10. The left upper trap was pain 1 that was stabbing, radiating into the left side of her head. And pain 2 was that muffled pounding feeling in her occipital region. She also had intermittent dizziness, worse with transitional movements like getting up from a chair or bending over, and nausea vomiting, which got better since the concussion. And she had intolerance of noise and computers. Aggravating factors were looking to the left, computer work and noise. Alleviating factors were over-the-counter Tylenol and laying down in a quiet area. She denied any change in vision, difficulty swallowing, fainting or paresthesia. She reported speech changes after the concussion, but they have since resolved. And then she denied history of smoking, oral contraceptive use, hypertension or diabetes, but she did have migraines, which were different than her current headaches. And then she also had treatment from a chiropractor for cervical manipulations and acupuncture, which had no effect on her symptoms.
Thank you for that description, Dr. Smolgovsky. As you clearly described, one of the key features of the situation is that there's an interesting confluence of different symptoms. That, of course, makes for a great clinical case, which is why this was published. So before we dive deeper into the other details of the case, can one of you speak to us in brief about the difficulty of the differential diagnostic process when it comes to a patient that presents with headaches like this?
Yeah, so absolutely. I think that's a great question. And I think as physical therapists, it's something that, you know, we underappreciate, and that being the differential diagnosis of headaches. You know, in our education, in physical therapy school, we typically discuss three types of headaches fairly distinctly: the cervicogenic headache, migraine headache, and tension type headaches. And, you know, those have fairly clear-cut differentiations for us. But, you know, if we look at the differential diagnosis of headaches, there's over 150 different unique headache types that have been described, each with their own unique constellation of signs and symptoms. And I think as we try to, you know, navigate our way through, we start to realize just how much overlap there is between the different categories and how much disagreement there is amongst the experts as to, you know, what each headache may or may not consist of. The general difficulty is understanding, you know, for patients such as this one who have the potential to have multiple concurrent headache types, which signs and symptoms fall in which constellation, and, you know, how we might want to better define and describe that headache type.
Thank you for that great answer. I really like how you encapsulate the academic and diagnostic part along with the clinical component. It certainly fits with my experience in the clinic. And now if we can distill that whole larger headache topic down to a level more specific to this case, the patient's presentation involved both a concussion and a cervicogenic headache. Why is that in particular difficult?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. I think that was really the diagnostic challenge as we worked through the process with this patient. What we know from the literature is that, you know, cervicogenic headache comes with a distinct constellation of signs and symptoms. It's unilaterality, it's provocation with neck movements. You know, as we think about post-concussive headaches, one of the things that's become abundantly clear in the literature is a lot of folks with post-concussive headaches also have cervicogenic dysfunctions. And so there's a lot of overlap and even some question as to whether or not some of the post-concussive headache is actually cervicogenic in nature. So trying to differentiate between those two in and of itself is a little bit of a challenge. For this patient in particular, the challenge was, exponentially larger in that she'd had symptoms that were somewhat discordant for both headache types with an overlapping migraine headache. And she complained of a muffled pulsatile type headache that really led you to think about vascular. And what we know about our vascular testing is it really lacks sensitivity. And so if we're not really able to rule out, you know, it becomes very difficult to say that this patient didn't also have some vascular component in her neck. As we think about a hypermobile middle-aged female who'd had an insidious onset of occipital pain, who complained of a throbbing pulsatile nature to it, who'd then also undergone several sessions of manipulation, under somebody else's hands. So we weren't able to see the pre-post effects. You know, and then this patient comes into our clinic and tells us, hey, I've got this headache and this concussion and this neck pain, and trying to really tweeze out what the differences were. And as we try to tweeze out the differences from, you know, what could potentially be vascular versus what is potentially post-concussive, the overlap between those two categories is probably even more challenging for us to say for certain, you know, which one is which. You know, so a patient that has dizziness and has dizziness with neck movements, who has dizziness with eye movements, and has, you know, findings where she complained of transiently, disrupted speech that really make us think about kind of our, you know, 5 Ds and 3 Ns of vertebral basilar dysfunction. And so this was a case where, you know, it was kind of, where's the preponderance of the evidence fall? And what's the most likely category for each of these? And, you know, as we've kind of weighed the strength of each finding and the likelihood that something was more concussive versus vascular, something that was more cervicogenic than vascular or concussive, you know, to try to find a path forward for this patient who came in with a fair amount of distress.
Excellent. I think that answer reflects this case well and moves us right into my next question nicely. What are some of the red flag scenarios that we should always be aware of with a patient that suffers headaches?
So some red flags that one needs to be aware of in patients that suffer from headaches are pathologies vascular in nature, such as the cervical arterial dysfunction and vertebrobasilar insufficiency. In the acute phase, these will present as ipsilateral neck pain and headache, or a combination of the two. And these are the ones that patients often come to the clinic with. but later on, their symptoms may include a neck pain and headache with those 5 D's and 3 N's, as well as gait ataxia, either at rest or with neck movements or positions. And it's important to consider these pathologies because they closely resemble cervicogenic headache or even concussion or post-concussive syndrome. So that's why careful assessment is required with these patients.
Thank you very much for that answer. I think we've set the stage well. That means it's time to get back to the clinical case. So what were the physical examination findings with this particular patient?
So to start her examination, we measured vitals, which are important to rule out vascular pathology, and those were negative. After that, I did a neuro screen for upper quarter, which is also negative, and followed by the upper cervical ligament testing, which is also negative, and they're intact. Cervical mobility-wise, range of motion was full but limited to her left, so we suspected that it was upper cervical restriction. So from then on, we went on to do the flexion rotation test. Now, the flexion rotation test was symmetrical bilaterally, but it was almost hypermobile because the normal range is about 45 degrees to both sides. She was more than that. So we suspected a possible hypermobility component in her. So we did the bite-in hypermobility index, which was positive for hypermobility.
Right. And at that point, after finding hypermobility in the presence of a negative flexion rotation test, we proceeded to try the side bend rotation test, which takes advantage of osseous locking as opposed to the soft tissue locking that goes with a flexion rotation test. That test was actually profoundly positive, where she had almost immediate limitation and reproduction of her headache pain with left rotation in the side bend rotation position. And, you know, considering the two tests, it's kind of interesting. If you look at the research on the flexion rotation test, they did an MRI study that shows that, you know, roughly a quarter of the motion that occurs during the FRT actually occurs below C2 in folks who have mobile soft tissues. And for somebody who has hypermobility or, some hyperlaxity in their system, that tends to be amplified. We took a look at that a couple of years ago and saw that, you know, you see a significant increase in the range of motion in the flexion rotation test as people become progressively more hypermobile, whereas the side bend rotation test tends to be fairly consistent as a measure of upper cervical mobility due to the articular locking. So I think that became an interesting piece of the puzzle for us to say, you know, we may want to go ahead and do some articular interventions for this patient and treat her C1, C2, despite the fact that, you know, she'd already had several rounds of manipulation that she reported gave her no real relief. Coming back around and saying, yeah, we still think there may be a joint problem, was a little bit of a surprise for the patient as well as for us, but something that, as we went through the case, became very meaningful.
And having mentioned that she had dizziness and difficulty with computer use and worse symptoms at the end of the day, I tested her vestibular ocular function, which showed dizziness with saccades rated at 5 out of 10 and headache with near point convergence at 8 centimeters, also rated at about 4 or 5 out of 10. We didn't do the vestibular ocular reflex or the visual motion sensitivity testing due to her irritability at that point in the evaluation. Later on in the plan of care, I tested her deep neck flexor endurance due to possible muscle performance limitations contributing to her symptoms, and that was 15 seconds, which is far below normal for a 40-year-old female, which is supposed to be about 40 seconds based on the norms for the test.
I like how thorough you were with the approach, and I can already see how you were thinking. Speaking of which, can you tell us more about your differential diagnosis process and how it progressed from there?
For this patient, vascular pathology in the neck needed to be ruled out, as she reported muffled and pounding occipital headache symptoms, dizziness, nausea, and vomiting, as well as altered speech, which could point to vertebral basilar insufficiency, as well as she reported recent head and neck trauma, history of migraines, recent cervical manipulation, which are risk factors for cervical artery dysfunction. Now, based on the symptoms present prior to her cervical manipulation, this could not be entirely ruled out based on this temporal relationship, as neck pain and headache are known symptoms of acute cervical artery dysfunction. However, she denied other risk factors such as high blood pressure, diabetes, oral contraceptives, tobacco use, and the altered speech could be linked to her concussion. And this is also further lowered from objective testing based on vertebral artery testing of sustained positional holds, normal cranial nerve exam, and normal blood pressure. Next step was to figure out how much of it was caused by her neck versus the concussion. So her cervicogenic symptoms were suggested by location of symptoms as well as neck movements provoking her symptoms. However, the dizziness, nausea, and vomiting suggested an alternative diagnosis. I did the flexion rotation test for which she was negative, where her range of motion exceeded 45 degrees bilaterally. Upper cervical ligamentous testing was negative, and then I did a bite and hypermobility index, which showed positive for hypermobility, suggesting that the result of the flexion rotation test was a false negative. Now, the flexion rotation test relies on soft tissue locking. So I did the side bend rotation test instead, which controls for laxity by using a bony block instead of the soft tissue block. And that was positive on her left for hypomobility and produced her left-sided headache. Following that, I did some joint assessment, which showed restricted, painful left C1-2 mobility, therefore supporting the upper cervical joint dysfunction causing her symptoms. Now, even though C1-2 was hypomobile, which supported the upper cervical spine being indicated in her symptoms, she did have recent chiropractic care that did not change her symptoms. So that may have contributed to other possible pathology contributing to her symptoms. Now, her concussion was suspected as a cause of her symptoms based on her mechanism of injury, headache, dizziness, nausea, and vomiting, along with sensitivity to light, noise, and then also speech changes. And then the exam findings showed abnormalities with saccades and near point convergence. However, her original headache symptoms in her occiput preceded the concussion. Based on clinical testing, it appeared that cervical artery dysfunction had low likelihood, and concussion was a more likely explanation for the findings of dizziness and saccade abnormalities. While other pathologies, including vestibular system dysfunction after concussion and cervical joint position error, could also explain the symptoms, based on subjective history report and objective findings, all that appeared consistent with a dual diagnosis of cervicogenic headache and concussion. So we decided to proceed with a trial of treatment to this patient.
That was a great transition because my next question has specifically to do with treatment. Can you walk us through what types of treatments were implemented as well as how the patient responded to those treatments?
Yeah, so with this patient, I think first it's important to highlight what we didn't do for treatment, and that was forceful end range upper cervical rotation techniques. Due to her hypermobility, due to her being a 40-year-old female with a history of migraines and recent cervical manipulation. So we instead started with prone upper cervical UPAs on the left side for C1-2, and the take-home version was the seated snags. However, she didn't really tolerate being in prone, and test-retest using left rotation and the side rotation test, they didn't have a huge carryover, so we instead modified the manual mobilizations and sitting using a seated atlanto-axial distraction technique. And this was shown to reduce stress on the vertebral artery blood flow. This performed in neutral, you could stabilize the caudal segments, which minimizes the influence of hyperlaxity. And so basically that technique was done until her cervical mobility was restored pain-free, and she had negative upper cervical hypomobility testing based on the side bend rotation test. Now, as her irritability decreased, Later in her plantar care, I tested her deep neck flexors, which were muscle endurance is poor, so I added upper cervical motor control exercises to further facilitate the gains of the manual techniques. As her headache symptoms improved, she still had residual dizziness symptoms, so I did the Buffalo Concussion Treadmill test to see if any of those were provoked with exertion. So she ended up self-terminating at the 10-minute mark, reaching about 65% of her heart rate max, walking at 3.2 miles an hour at a 9% incline, and she gave that self-perceived exertion a 10 out of 10. This was more of a self-termination due to decreased endurance versus symptoms. So we gave her a home-graded exercise program in order to promote recovery and deconditioning from concussion based on the research, which shows that concussion's worse by prolonged rests, and using a progressive aerobic training program showed good results in patients with concussion to reduce deconditioning and promote functional brain healing without the need for pharmaceutical interventions.
I think one of the elements that really needs to stand out here in the both differential diagnosis and treatment of this patient is how we proceeded in the face of some uncertainty diagnostically. Right, we were never able to completely rule out the possibility of vascular involvement, as much as we could likely rule in cervicogenic involvement and concussive involvement. And so it was an ongoing assessment using a test treat retest model, and continually monitoring our patient's concordant signs and seeing which of these interventions allowed us to progress and continue. And it was that constant reassessment that allowed us to then progress to the point where we got to the phase where the cervicogenic impairments were almost completely resolved and the patient still had the residual concussive complaints, and we were able to proceed to a Buffalo concussion treadmill test and address those final elements for this patient.
You've already partially gotten to this point, but in general, what were the patient outcomes?
So this patient had full resolution of symptoms at the 6-week mark. Her NDI score went from 48% to 2%. Her deep neck flexor performance improved to well above the normal range for that population. She had negative vestibular ocular tests, negative upper cervical mobility tests for any abnormalities. And she reported returning to full function, ability to drive, perform work activities without symptoms. She just had her residual baseline migraine headaches at the time of discharge.
And as a last question, and I know this is a really broad question that entire books have been written about, but in brief, based on both this case and your general knowledge of the available evidence, what's your advice for physical therapists when they encounter a case like this?
I think cases like this are more common than we give credit to. I think our patients have become, progressively more complex over time. We see patients with more comorbidities and more factors to consider during the exam and during our assessment process. I think, maintaining a wide diagnostic funnel early in the process, using the screening tests that are available to us to the best of our ability to rule out pathologies, to make sure that we're dealing with what we really think we are, narrowing down our focus at the end and trying to find concordant findings for our patient, and having something that allows us to have a test, treat, retest methodology to differentiate our patient's response to our interventions as opposed to the passage of time and the influence of all the other factors that go into our patient experience. Really, the keys to a case like this. And, I think the other big piece is, we function in a world of diagnostic uncertainty. Pretty much every special test that's ever come out that starts off saying it has sensitivity of 100 or anything close to it, when it's been tested 4 or 5 times, suddenly we're down into the, 70s and 80s. And there's always that unknown as to whether or not our patient may have been, our false negative. Our patient may actually have something worrisome. And so we need to continually monitor our patient's symptoms, revisit their presentation, and not just go through the motions and say, I figured out the treatment on day one, I'm going to continue to use it. The situation changes over time, and we need to change with it. And I think the other big piece of the puzzle here is, you know, when we do have uncertainty, we don't necessarily have to take a home run swing on the first treatment. Sticking our toe in the water with something maybe a little more gentle can help us be more certain of our path and of our answer. The picture of cervicogenic headache and concussion became much more clear over the course of about 3 sessions than it was on day 1, both from a patient rapport building standpoint and from a patient response standpoint once we did a test intervention. And, you know, if we go in sometimes a little bit softer, there's a kind of a lower stakes game there that we're playing, as opposed to saying, yeah, I need to do a home run treatment on day 1 and try to cure this, and then find out, oops, that wasn't really cervicogenic hypomobility. That actually was something vascular. That was something more worrisome. And, you know, I think just keeping an open mind and an open perspective and funneling our treatments through would really be the way to go in the face of uncertainty.
Well, I think that's sage advice and a great place to wrap things up. Dr. Smolgovsky, Dr. Swanson, thank you both for your work on this case. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you, Stephen. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
This has been a production of the American Academy of Orthopedic Manual Physical Therapists. You can learn more about the Academy by visiting our website at aaompt.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching for our acronym, AAOMPT. The views and opinions expressed on the AOMPT podcast are those of the interviewers and interviewees and do not represent the official position of AOMPT. The information presented should not be used as personal healthcare or clinical practice advice. If you need to find an expert orthopedic physical therapist near you, then check out the Find a Fellow feature under the Public Resources tab at www.aaompt.org, which you can find in the show notes.